Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Esme Murphy with you, along with producer Jonathan Lowe and one of my absolute favorite guests, Professor David Schultz of Hamline University. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well, and Happy New Year to everybody.
Happy New Year. Well, listen, we have been talking this past half hour about the remarkable series of events that have occurred with the U.S. taking action and assassinating General Soleimani, as well as other top Iraqi and Iranian officials in that strike. Your take on this, because and we just finished talking with a couple of experts, including Tom Gutierrez, the former dean of Middle Eastern Studies at University of Nebraska. He said he was shocked by this.
I was shocked also by this, but in the sense that the Trump administration, or at least Donald Trump, is facing a challenge. And the challenge is after we pulled out of the Iranian nuclear agreement about a year ago, for a while Iran was playing, let's say, relatively conservative politics, trying to keep a coalition of people together by not really sort of, you know, aggravating anything. But it's now restarted its nuclear program. It shot down, or rather it shot missiles into Saudi Arabia. And the United States is sort of stuck in the Trump administration, is that it's seeing the acceleration of Iran's influence. It's seeing the acceleration of the nuclear program. It's also seeing Iran support Hezbollah and a few other terrorist organizations. And so I think the Trump administration didn't have a lot of other options at this point, and this becomes, I think, partly the reason for the strike that they did.
And in terms of, you know, what happens next, I think nobody seems to know, but there does seem to be, amongst experts, including the two ones we just talked to, there does seem to be the widespread belief that the Iranians will, in fact, follow through, and that there will be some form of major retaliation. What I mean, and there are obviously those people who are concerned about seeing this escalate Absolutely. Into possibly an all-out war. Is that something that you see as well?
I do. And here are some possibilities for where I think the escalation could occur. One possibility is going to be right in Iraq, because we have the infiltration of Iran into many of the organizations in Iraq, and we have U.S. troops that are there. So I would expect that to be one. Two, I wouldn't be surprised if we saw yet another effort to launch missiles against Saudi Arabia. Three, again, I mentioned Hezbollah before, and since Iran is supporting them, there could very well be coordination with them in some type of attack, either through Israel or against the United States. But the point being is that I think Iran has lots of possibilities for where it can sort of step next, and it may not happen today or tomorrow, but I think most people are certain that something is going to happen short of a direct military conflict or direct military attack against the United States.
And in terms of, you know, possibly, you know, what's going on both, you know, domestically as well as internationally, I mean, in terms of what the president is facing, you've got that impeachment trial looming, and some of his fiercest critics are saying, well, the president did this in order to distract from that. It's hard to believe that is actually the case because of the drastic implications of this. But certainly people are talking about this as opposed to impeachment.
Well, they are. I was going to say is that you might recall back in 1998 when Clinton was facing impeachment, he launched strikes against Iran, and which basically became the premise. Remember the movie Wag the Dog,
right?
And I'm hearing in the last few days, you're probably hearing it also too, that is this Wag the Dog the sequel or something like that. Now, Whether that is the case or not, that is, I think, a matter of debate. But there's no question of the fact that in the last 72 hours, discussion of impeachment has somewhat faded from the headlines. But what this now suggests is think of three stories that are now converging. If the first two stories were impeachment, rather the looming Senate trial on impeachment charges and the 2020 election, now add to that possible war with Iran, or let's just say significant escalation with Iran, we've got three different major events or stories that are converging together, and that makes it for a fairly unpredictable, you know, sort of cocktail in terms of how it's all going to play out.
In terms of the president, you know, he has said that he did this in order to prevent a war, not to start one. And he has campaigned in 2016 very successfully. He won, saying he wanted to get us out of endless wars. It does seem, with 3,000 troops headed to the region because of this situation, that we are really in danger of slipping back into one.
Well, we are. And keep in mind that the president is trying to pull troops out of both Syria and pull troops out of Afghanistan at the same time. And now we have this shifting of troops over into the Middle East, you know, to defend against potentially, you know, further escalation with Iran. It certainly does look like at this point that we're not going to see any significant de-escalation in Middle East tensions, and that the president is walking into exactly what he said he wanted to avoid, which is yet another conflict. I think, you know, this all comes back to the decision to pull out of the Iranian nuclear accords, because once we did that, it was impossible not to expect that there would be some type of retaliation. For however good or however bad those accords were, what they did was to at least buy some time and buy some stability between the United States and Iran for perhaps several years. And once we pulled out of that agreement, you had to expect at some point that Iran was going to take action or retaliate in some way. And so this is really just a continuation of really, I think, is a contradictory set of rhetoric that Trump had from 2016. Contradictory rhetoric saying that he wanted to pull out of the Iranian nuclear accords and make sure Iran didn't become a nuclear power. At the same time, he wanted to ensure or say that we were going to pull out of our Middle East engagements. Those were contradictory messages, and they're really coming into collision right now.
Right. And the other thing is the president, I mean, no one has been more critical of his own intelligence establishment conclusions mm-hmm. and analysis than this president.
Right.
Time and time again, yet he says he is following the recommendations of that same intelligence establishment.
Well, that will become interesting here, because that's sort of what's being said right now. What we don't know is to what extent this is actually accurate. And this is where you normally would be having now what? The consultation with Congress, which did not occur before the strike, and B, you would oftentimes post-strike like this, you would have hearings in Congress to evaluate and determine what, in fact, the intelligence community said. And there very well could be, on the one hand, the military could have said that, yes, given where he's located, it is possible to take him out. Given possibly where we are, let's say militarily, this might have made sense. But from a larger political perspective, it might not have made sense in terms of doing this. And again, this is one of the things that probably the House and the Senate and Foreign Intelligence Committees are going to have to evaluate in terms of what's going on. But also keep in mind that the president has significantly crippled the intelligence community over the last 3 years. So regarding how good the information was they provided him also is questionable.
Well, although the intelligence information that guy was landing on that plane.
That was accurate, yes.
That was accurate as heck.
That was deadly accurate, pardon the pun there, but it's absolutely correct. But again, whether or not it made sense to say,
right,
let's take him out, is a different question entirely, because most of the analysts who are the experts, and most of the world is saying that this was a hugely destabilizing action to essentially what? To assassinate not a leader, but certainly a significant leader of a foreign country.
Right. As opposed to, I think it's interesting that people have drawn the distinction between al-Baghdadi and Osama bin Laden, who were not leaders of a nation, but they were leaders of a terrorist organization. Here, you've got a nation that's involved. I think a lot of people are just kind of going, what happens next? How is this going to affect? Obviously, we are in the middle of an election we're hurtling towards. The Iowa caucuses. We're hurtling towards the Democratic primaries. Obviously, the president is going to be the Republican nominee. You've seen all the Democrats basically say, in essence, the same thing. This was a bad guy. This was somebody who was terrible. Obviously, two previous presidents, George W. Bush and President Obama, had considered trying to take this guy out and decided not to because they felt it would be, as the word you used, too destabilizing and too dangerous and too consequential for the U.S. and its allies. But what are the implications as we move forward here? In this very critical time, as voters are trying to figure out who should be the next president of the United States, or if President Trump should get another 4 more years?
Well, sort of two observations. First, for those of us who are old enough to remember this, some of this reminds me of 1979 and the Iranian hostage crisis, and where the Carter presidency was brought down in the election in part because of the administration's inability to be able to address the hostage situation involving Iran. And I don't know how this is going to play out. For example, if we get involved in a military conflict, is it possible that there will be hostages taken? Now, remember, of course, there is no U.S. embassy in Iran now, so that's not the issue. But it wouldn't be impossible for a U.S. embassy in Iraq to be stormed, or people.
Well, it almost was.
Almost was, exactly, yes. Exactly. And so if history means anything, and sometimes it does, and sometimes it doesn't, this could remind many people of how, again, a previous president was brought down by conflict with Iran. And keep in mind also, Iran is very different than Iraq, very different than, let's say, Syria or Afghanistan. This is an enormously large country, tens of millions of people more than we saw with than Iraq or Afghanistan. And so any kind of a skirmish there is going to be dangerous. And as we learned a few months ago, we were surprised as a country regarding how accurate their missiles were when they took out some of those Saudi Arabian oil facilities. So having said all of that, this now becomes with 29 days before the Iowa caucuses, this now becomes a major issue going into the Iowa caucuses in terms of how it factors, as you pointed out, the different candidates who are going to be debating as early as this coming week in Iowa, but also how does this affect voters in terms of what they're looking at. And I suspect we're going to see, which is typical of what we've seen for the last few years, a partisan breakdown. I suspect the initial polls will be that Trump supporters support what he did, Democrats oppose what he did, and there's going to be the independents who are going to break down, I'm going to guess, mostly against the actions that are there, but a certain percentage will support and love a certain percentage who are going to be what? Just not sure. So I think we're going to see the typical partisan reaction to this as we've seen for almost everything else.
Right. And I think that is definitely a good bet there. Obviously, we are getting very close. It is less than a month to the Iowa caucuses. You've got a major debate coming up on January 14th. It's interesting. There's a debate in Iowa on January 14th in Des Moines. I believe it's at Drake University, uh-huh, where I think they've already had one. But on that very same day, the president has chosen to make an appearance in Wisconsin. He'll be speaking in the Milwaukee area at a campaign rally. Makes you think that we are appreciated in terms of this region, that people are not overlooking us.
That's right.
This time around.
No, you're right. I mean, in many ways, You know, I've done this analysis. I know a few other people have done this. Wisconsin may be the state that determines the election.
And we've heard that again and again. And is that simply because, once again, they are a swing state? I mean, you've written a book on swing states.
Yep.
And they were the swing state that so many people did not expect to swing for President Trump, and they did in 2016.
They did, yeah. If the calculations that I did, I can't remember if I sent them to you a few weeks ago. About 2 weeks ago, I did the calculations. Okay, Wisconsin has 10 electoral votes. If you take Wisconsin out of the equation, I have the election right now with Democratic candidate with 268 electoral votes, with a Republican candidate, Donald Trump, 260. You need 270 electoral votes to win the election. And this is assuming, by the way, that Democrats still do take Minnesota. And right now, my calculation is that Donald Trump wins a second term in the Electoral College, 270 to 268.
By winning Wisconsin.
By winning Wisconsin, and 270 is the bare minimum. But to show you how close this can be at this point is that if we keep in mind that occasionally we get what's called the faithless elector who switches, or keep in mind that Nebraska and the state of Maine don't allocate all or nothing, play with us a little bit. I am not ruling out scenarios in this election that it could be, what, 269, and it goes to the U.S. House of Representatives to pick the next president of the United States.
Wow. Okay. Because that's, in other words, those electors, you never think of it, they actually are casting votes in that Electoral College process. If it's that close, are they bound? Are they not bound? And again, you've got these two states that do it proportionately. I mean, that's an interesting scenario. You actually think that this could be the year, perhaps, that could happen?
It could happen. We haven't had Congress pick a president since the 1880s, where it got resolved there. I don't think it's inconceivable. I mean, I think Donald Trump's going to lose the popular vote. I mean, that seems pretty clear when you look at the big, heavy Democratic states like California and New York. The Democratic candidate's going to rack up large, large numbers there. But I think it's going to really come down to it's the race for 270, the Electoral College, and it's conceivable. Now, just so people start to hear it here first, if it does, if no candidate gets a majority of the electoral vote, and it's happened a couple of times, the House of Representatives picks the President of the United States, but it's the House of Representatives that would be elected this coming November, which means the incoming House would do this. And now, to make it more interesting, is that when the vote occurs in the House of Representatives, it's not where each House member gets one vote. States vote as a delegation, which means if you have a state that's...
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So Minnesota has to vote as a delegation.
They have to vote
Minnesota's delegation is pretty split.
Right. And so if it was split down the middle... let's say, actually, right now, it's 5-3, if I remember correctly, isn't it?
Correct. We have 5 Democrats and 3 Republicans.
Right.
You do have the interesting situation with Collin Peterson, though,
yeah,
who has been, voting with the Republicans on impeachment issues.
Right, but I think
he is a Democrat.
But he would, assuming he runs, assuming he's reelected, assuming Democrats were to hold a 5-3, it would be... a vote would go for at that point. I'm assuming Collin Peterson would vote for the Democratic president. But what's interesting is each state gets one vote. Right now, the Republicans hold 26. Even though Democrats hold a majority of the total House seats,
wow,
Republicans control overall 26 of the states. And so you could have an even stranger scenario, let's say next year, that if the Democrats still hold the majority in the House, but the Democrats hold, or the Republicans hold the majority of the actual states, you could have Donald Trump win that way.
Wow. You know, and I know you travel, you travel a lot overseas. How do you begin to explain that one to folks overseas?
Well, this is complex. This is difficult. I mean, this is one of the more frequent topics that I have to talk about when I do like talks for the U.S. embassies or the State Department or go to other schools. Is just explain the Electoral College, and it all depends on detail. I mean, I usually just stop with 270 electoral votes. I talk about it being 50 separate state elections. If people really want to press it, then I can say, okay, now let's talk about the real oddities in terms of if the House has to pick people, if the Senate has to pick the vice president, because this is actually a very, very complex process. And I know even domestically in the United States, I've already done, I think, last year and now going into this year, I'll probably do about a half a dozen or a dozen community talks, you know, like to neighborhood organizations or to, you know, professional associations, and just try to explain the Electoral College, because it is...
You're probably going to be really in demand, and not that you aren't already.
Yeah, but and especially given the fact that I do envision scenarios where it could be the House of Representatives that does it this time, because that's how truly divided we are and how close we are.
Right. Well, and you know, one thing that I've noticed, you know, as the Democrats sort of slug it out, and you've got you know, Mike Bloomberg coming in with all these commercials that are super slick and very well done. You see him getting traction in some polls. You've got the president who, despite all these controversies, despite impeachment, despite, you know, a lot of the controversial issues involving this strike in Iraq against the Iranian general, the president is running a really good campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And I have mentioned this before. I've been so struck by the fact that his people are so organized, that his campaign is so organized and down to the local level, where they are repeatedly reaching out to local reporters to see, you know, do you need a surrogate to talk about the president? I mean, it's such a contrast to what happened 4 years ago when they barely had anything, because,
right,
you know, it was sort of almost the campaign that was on the fly.
You're right. And I think 4 years ago, even the president, even Donald Trump, I think, was somewhat surprised that he won. This time, and he wasn't as well prepared. This time, he's very well prepared. And there's a great contrast you're doing here. Michael Bloomberg is doing what we call the air wars, a lot of money in advertising. But what Donald Trump is doing is something I think even more important. It's called the ground wars. It's organizing. It's getting people out. It's doing what you just said here. It's making it known to, let's say, WCCO and says, do you need somebody to come in,
right,
and talk about? That's incredibly important stuff.
And that is happening. I will tell you on a daily basis that they are that organized. And I do think it does make a difference that they are clearly looking at Minnesota. I mean, they are clearly looking at Minnesota. And, you know, I don't know if it's their thought that Minnesota would be the hedge against if they lose Wisconsin. I suppose that's one theory. But they are clearly looking at picking up Minnesota.
Yeah, I think there's two different theories here. One, is Minnesota actually in play? I actually do think it is. I think the fact that he got so close, you know, less than 50,000 votes, Trump almost won the state. And
with very little effort, just the effort at the end where he came here.
Exactly. Yeah. And the fact that in greater Minnesota, he's incredibly popular. So one theory is that the state is actually in play. Theory number two, if you force the Democrats to have to defend Minnesota, a state they never normally have to defend, every dollar you spend to defend Minnesota is a dollar
you can't spend
in Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan, or Iowa. Yeah.
And that is a good one, because I don't see how the Democrats cannot defend Minnesota with the fact that the president almost won here in 2016, and the fact that he is so organized here. And the Trump campaign has really done a very good job of getting organized early and taking that huge advantage of incumbency to get organized, to get everything in place, to not take things for granted. And that's really a remarkable, remarkable situation. Bloomberg's candidacy is something that I think is really fascinating. And you know, we do have to take a break coming up here for weather. But I would like to talk to you about that, because one of the things that, you know, I was reading about the next debate, January 14th, and of course, Bloomberg is not in it. And then I realized he can't be in any of the debates because he's not taking any contributions.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to get into these debates, so far there are only going to be five candidates in the next Democratic debate. And they are Joe Biden, they are Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Pete Buttigieg, and Amy Klobuchar. And it's there's they've upped the guidelines for getting in. You have to get more and more people contributing to your campaign, more and more people contributing from different states, and you have to get higher levels in all of these polls, which, you know, Amy Klobuchar, credit to her, has done that. But Michael Bloomberg is not taking any public contributions. He is self-funding his entire campaign, and he's spending a lot of money, if you can judge by the commercials. And he is seeing some return on that investment. We are going to take a quick break here. We're going to give you some weather. And when we come back, we're going to chat with David Schultz about Michael Bloomberg and what about this strategy? Is it going to work? Has this kind of thing ever been really attempted before at this level? And does he have a chance when it comes to Super Tuesday? Keep it here. You're listening to News Talk 830. All right, we are back. Esme Murphy, along with producer Jonathan Lowe and the one and only Professor David Schultz. Let's talk Michael Bloomberg. He had actually doubled his best in one of the polls in the short time he's been in the race at 11% in one of the national polls. He is saturating the airwaves, certainly in this state and other states. Is he going to be able to pull this off? And he won't be in the debates, which I think a lot of people will expect to see him in the debates, and I think we might be a little surprised that he won't be in the debates. He won't be in any of the debates if he continues to not take in any kinds of contributions from the public. Does he have a chance?
I never want to say never for two reasons. First, remember, people thought that Donald Trump had no chance 4 years ago.
Exactly, especially after the Access Hollywood tape.
Exactly, and so you never want to say never. And two, again, sounding like distant history, there was another, I suspect, billionaire whose name Ross Perot, who spent heavily back in the 90s, and he wound up getting, 18% of the popular vote running as a third-party candidate. And I just mention this because he also didn't have significant ground game, started off with simply spending an incredible amount of money on advertising, was running at a time when there was disenchantment, 1992, with the two major candidates, Bill Clinton and with George Bush Sr. And think about it now. What if we have a scenario where perhaps maybe the Democrats aren't completely thrilled, or many Democrats aren't completely thrilled with the top four or top five candidates and are looking for somebody else? Going into Super Tuesday, where nobody has really emerged as a clear front runner, I wouldn't completely rule it out. Now, also throw in one more parallel here. You know, when people are saying, "Well, why would somebody vote for a billionaire?" Well, we have a billionaire who is a president right now. So again, my simple statement is: don't rule it out. We live in a culture that's far more driven by the media than I think we oftentimes want to give credit to, especially when it comes to politics. And that name recognition may do it with all those ads. They're good ads.
And they're good ads. They're positive ads. They're very well produced. They got his name out there. In terms of the Iowa caucuses, you mentioned there doesn't seem to be a clear front runner. One of the things that's a little startling is that there hasn't been more polling. We haven't really had a major poll in some time in just Iowa. What do you think about that?
Well, there's a piece that I did 4 years ago, and I talked to several different people about this, including people at the Pew Center, Pew Research Center, which is a wonderful group. And we were talking about the economics of polling, and a good poll, a good basic poll that would give us good information, including in the state of Iowa, is going to start at the cheapest level at probably $50,000 to $60,000 to $70,000. And I just mention that because when you traditionally used to think about who would do polling, it would be a newspaper or maybe a television station.
Right.
Not too many newspapers and television stations have $50,000 to $100,000
just sitting around. Yes,
sitting around to do a poll, and so I think that's part of what's going on at this point right now, is that it is incredibly expensive to do good polls, that you're probably, and our listeners are probably very similar to me. I rarely pick up my landline, and even on my cell phone, I oftentimes don't pick up if I don't recognize a number. Most polls to be able to that are considered effective now need to do about 80% cell phone, about 20% landline. Very few people pick up landlines. Getting accurate cell phone information is very complicated. For example, if I want to do a poll in Iowa, and I don't even remember what the area codes are in Iowa at this point, so pardon me, but we're going to have a lot of people in Iowa who live there who may not even have an Iowa area code on their cell phone.
Absolutely.
And those who do have area codes for Iowa may not live in Iowa anymore. So pinpointing and matching cell phones to numbers to addresses become also exceedingly expensive. So it's just become a very complex process that's very costly, because the more people you have to call to do an accurate poll, the more the costs go up. And so I think it's the cost factor more than anything else. And so we're all speculating. We're all speculating on where we think Iowa is right now, on top of which caucuses are harder to predict than primaries.
Right. I did see one analysis that said that, you know, certainly Senator Amy Klobuchar has done very well in debates. In some of these polls, she's ticked up certainly a few percentage points. She had a record haul in terms of fundraising at $11 million, which is still way below Buttigieg, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, and Biden. But I was reading about the fact that in for many Iowans, she apparently is a second choice.
Right.
And this article pointed out that wasn't such a bad thing, because if the candidates don't have a certain threshold at the caucus, then they have to switch to another candidate.
Right.
So maybe that'll help someone like an Amy Klobuchar, who insists that she is getting momentum and is gaining momentum. It's possible that she really is. But what we have now are polls from early December that show Pete Buttigieg ahead. And it's not clear if those are still reflecting that. I mean, we've had people cycle in and cycle out of dominance in that particular state.
Correct. If we look at the most recent polls that we have, we've got the top four, you know, who are Buttigieg, Biden, Warren, and Sanders. Klobuchar comes in a relatively distant fifth, she's fifth. And I just mention this because the top four right now would have enough support, assuming that based on the polls from the last few weeks, would have enough to be viable, so that assuming everything played out the way it is, Klobuchar would probably still come in at about fifth. And this raises a really interesting question now, is that given how much she's placed upon Iowa in terms of her strategy, if she were to come in fifth, what damage does it do to her campaign? And I mention this because if we also look at other polling nationwide, you know, right after we have Iowa, we have New Hampshire, then we have Nevada, then we have South Carolina. And in those three states, she's polling with numbers significantly worse than in Iowa. Now, I know she's hoping that Iowa becomes a kind of a springboard, but I'll throw it back to you and ask, so if she comes in fifth, what impact do you think that has?
I don't think it does much for her at all.
Yes.
But if she comes in second or a close third, I think that could be a game changer for her. And I think that that's what her folks are counting on. And I think the Klobuchar campaign thinks that's a realistic possibility. And I guess it probably is, with so much up in the air.
Yeah, and that's what she needs. I think you're right. You know, politics, especially Iowa, is oftentimes not about absolute victory, but about relative expectations or beating expectations.
Right.
Right now, the prediction is fifth. I'm still not sure fourth does it for her, but I think she has to be probably the top three. Now, if she does edge out the fourth place person at this point, I think that does help her a little bit. But I do think she's got to crack one, two, or three, and I think really to have a viable campaign, probably it has to be two.
And you know, I agree with you. It's the expectations game, and with that particular theory, what you just mentioned, I also think that in the Iowa caucuses, if Joe Biden doesn't win or Pete Buttigieg doesn't win, I think they will be badly hurt. And I think if Joe Biden has a poor showing, like a third, that could really spell trouble for him.
I think you're right. And this takes us back to 2008, where the expectation was that Hillary Clinton was going to win, and she came in third behind both Barack Obama and John Edwards. You know, I mean, coming in second was a blow, but to come in third was really devastating for her. And I think the same thing here. Biden and Buttigieg, actually, I'm going to say Biden and Buttigieg and even Warren, I think all three of them have to win it. I really do, because the expectation is going to be that Warren should win New Hampshire, although it's going to be a tough battle, you know, with Bernie Sanders.
Well,
you know,
they're both sandwiched on either side of New Hampshire.
Yeah. Exactly. You know, New Hampshire is the bologna between two slices of bread between the other two. You know, and I think Sanders has enough money, and he's going to keep going for a while. But I really do think that three of those candidates, in fact, again, I'll throw all four, including Klobuchar, those four have to do very well in Iowa. Sanders can take a hit, given the money and given, I think, some of his strategy. But those other four all four of them have to finish in the top two.
You know, one thing, you know, in terms of reading about Senator Klobuchar's push in Iowa, and she has spent a lot of time there, probably more than any other candidate, she did go to every single county in Iowa, including the Republican counties, and she's doing that in New Hampshire, too.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't help but think, that's a pretty smart idea,
mm-hmm.
because there have to be some Republicans. I mean, this president is such a non-traditional president and such a non-traditional Republican that he's obviously attracted people who are not Republicans to him. He's attracted independents, but he's got to have alienated some people who are sort of more mainstream Republicans. Is it possible that that's a strategy that obviously Amy Klobuchar is embracing, but that other candidates will try and embrace as well? Going forward towards the general election?
Well, general election, I think that makes sense. For the caucuses and primaries, less so. I know people have always talked for years back when we, you know, with our caucuses too, or even, let's say, our primaries, that there's always sort of the myth of the malicious voter, the Democrat who goes over and votes for the weakest Republican or vice versa. And there's actually very little evidence of that. In Iowa, given the fact that the participation in the caucuses is 5 to 7%, 8% of the population. The people who show up to the caucuses for both Republican and Democratic side, they're the hardcores. I mean, these are the hardcore.
Is the turnout really that low in Iowa?
Yeah,
just 5 to 7%?
Yeah.
After all this fuss, it's 5 to 7% of people in Iowa who are deciding this.
Right. Of a state that's actually a fairly small population also. Yeah, I mean, I was going to say, even in Minnesota, you know, again, we're going to be needing to talk more about this in the next few weeks, the fact that we're shifting to a presidential primary as opposed to a caucus. And I think we need to talk about that at some point. But even in our best years, you know, for our presidential caucuses, we were looking at less than 10% of the eligible voters showing up for the caucuses. And so the caucuses are hugely, let's say, unrepresentative in terms of the general voting population, although they're pretty representative, maybe, of the parties that they represent.
Yeah, I thought with all the attention, you know, in Iowa, with, you know, people meeting candidates, not just meeting, you know, one candidate, but meeting maybe all of them or like three or four of them, shaking their hands, going to a meeting, that perhaps the turnout would be even higher. But I think that's something that has yet to be seen. In terms of Minnesota, let's talk about that. Minnesota and its primary. We're going to take a quick break here. When we come back, more with David Schultz on the fact that Minnesota has a presidential primary that is part of Super Tuesday, a day, March 3rd, when I believe a third of the delegates will be selected for the convention. It is 8:46 in the Twin Cities right now. Esme Murphy chatting with Professor David Schultz. Let's talk about that Minnesota primary. Primary, folks, not a caucus, on March 3rd will be part of Super Tuesday, a day when 14 states will go to the polls and a lot of delegates are going to be decided. I think it's about a third, isn't it?
That's correct. It's about a third. And so let's talk about the primary, because this is going to be the first time we've had a presidential primary since the early 1970s. And this is pretty significant, because keep in mind, unlike the caucuses, where many people know you would have to show up, what, about 7 o'clock at night, and it would be only taking place at night. This is going to be a primary, which means it's going to be an all-day election, the normal election hours that you see in Minnesota, which I think is, what, 6 in the morning until, is it 6 in the morning, or is it 7 in the morning, I think it is, till 8 o'clock at night. I'm forgetting the exact starting time in the morning, but it's going to be all day. Additionally, because it's a primary, there's going to be what? Early voting. So people are going to be able to early vote in the primary, too. So I think
starting on January 17th, folks.
Yes.
You're actually going to be able to vote in the presidential primary.
That's right. And what's interesting is technically then we actually can cast the first votes.
Right. Isn't that cool?
Yes. Minnesota actually cast the first votes in the 2020 presidential selection process. So we actually beat Iowa by, what, 14 days or something.
Right. So in other words, the early voting, which is a huge amount of time because of the need to make sure we can get all of our ballots to those who are serving overseas and have them return them to us, it starts on January 17th. You'll be able to vote for president in here in Minnesota in the Minnesota presidential primary.
That's right. Right. Now, the other thing that people need to understand also about this, which is going to be interesting, and I don't know what impact it's going to have, by the way, is that when you show up to vote in the primary, you're going to, and it's only the Democrats and Republicans are having primaries, by the way. The other minor parties, there are other major parties in the state, aren't going to be on the ballot for the primaries. But when you show up, you're going to have to indicate, do you want a Republican ballot or a Democratic ballot? And the reason why this is going to be important is that the parties will know whether you selected a Democrat or Republican, but that information won't be available to the general public.
Right. Or so they say.
So they say. Although I suspect that's either going to be probably challenged in court, or I suspect at some point people's names are going to get sold from the party to somebody else, et cetera, et cetera. But I just mention this because I know when people go, for example, to the regular primaries in Minnesota, you know, in August, you don't have to indicate and say I'm doing Democrat or Republican. And I don't know at this point how this is going to play with Minnesotans in terms of having to say I'm declaring Democrat or Republican. Many states, for example, the state of New York, to vote in a primary, you actually have to designate and say I'm a Democrat or I'm a Republican.
Right. Right. And you have to do it weeks beforehand.
Yes.
Here you have to do it at the time that you vote. I do think that's interesting. I have spoken with the Secretary of State, Steve Simon. He says he's actually going to bring legislation at right when the legislative session begins, which I believe is February 13th, to actually overturn that so you wouldn't have to do that or else the list wouldn't go there. I'm not sure exactly what his specific proposal is, but he's opposed to that. And so – but that's cutting it pretty close, though.
It is cutting it pretty close.
And there will already have been all these people that will have voted.
Exactly. So I suspect it may not have an impact this time. And I know the parties don't like this idea because they actually want to know who's voting. You know, in the same way that when it's the caucuses, they know if Jane Doe, you know, or John Doe shows up to a caucus because they use the caucuses as a way of what? Fundraising, party building, and they want to use the primary for that purpose also. So this is not going to be an easy move, you know, for the Secretary of State to change this. But again, this is going to be interesting because, and we've talked about this before, you know, Minnesotans are very private people.
Right.
And I'm not sure how the idea of having to designate and say you are a Democrat or Republican or casting one way or the other, what the impact is going to be.
But the only thing you're voting on is the presidential race.
Exactly.
Okay. Because there are other parties as well.
Yeah.
We've got the two marijuana parties.
That's right. That's right.
And there will also be another primary in August when you'll be voting for, you know, different House positions and that kind of thing. So there still will be another primary. But I agree with you. I don't think people are going to like it. It's interesting. I was there when Ken Martin, the chair of the DFL party, filed his slate of candidates that will be on the primary ballot that Minnesotans will get to decide from. And he said that he doesn't like the idea of the parties knowing or getting these lists of this because he said, in his opinion, the Democrats are so much better organized than Republicans that it's giving Republicans sort of an advantage they don't have. He says that, you know, we've got all the Democrats figured out, but Republicans don't have as good an organization as we do, and it's going to help them more than it's going to help us, which was an interesting point.
It is, except I'm not sure if the Republicans are as disorganized as the Democrats think they are. I think the other side always wants always wants to make that claim there. But even with this concern there about the designation of party, again, if I can do a parallel here, you know, when we're getting about 7 to 8% of our voters to show up for the caucuses, right next door in Wisconsin, which has a primary, they've been getting about 38 to 40% of their voters. And so I have to think that no matter what, we're going to see a dramatic uptick in terms of the number of people who participate in the primaries, which on balance is good. We ought to have more people involved.
Right, right. And it's too, you know, I mean, I was, and I think I've shared that with you, I've shared it with some listeners too. I actually covered the Democratic caucuses in 2016, which went overwhelmingly for Bernie Sanders, and I was assigned to a school in St. Paul, and I can't remember the name of the school. It was so crowded that people actually fainted.
Yeah.
And for people who were disabled, it was almost impossible to get in.
No, you're right.
I mean, it was a terrible situation. Or for people who had small children, I mean, it was just something that was just not conducive to participating in democracy, because it was just completely – I mean, it was great that all those people turned out, but it was way more than anyone expected.
That's right. We had traffic jams in some places, you know, across the Twin Cities and across Minnesota, for people trying to show up all at the same place at the same time.
Yeah, it was not good.
Right, and you're absolutely right. And the fact that we have people who worked second shift, who had child care duties and so forth, who were ill, couldn't make it. And so the fact that we have all day – and we have the early voting is good. And we've talked about this before. You know, one of the groups of people who most takes advantage of early voting are women with children, working women with children.
Right. Well, and it's completely understandable. So I think that will be – I think everyone agreed that there was a problem. I was at the Democratic caucus, but I think Republican caucuses were also jammed. Because remember, there were all those candidates as well. So it just – both sides were struggling to handle, you know, the turnout or whatever. Remember Marco Rubio? That should be a good trivia question.
That's right.
Who won the Republican caucuses in 2016 in Minnesota?
That was the only state he won, I think.
I think it's the only state he won. Marco Rubio won. And it's you know, it's really amazing when you think back on that volatile campaign. But so we will have that. The first contest, though, it remains to be seen if somebody can pull a maneuver. And the person who's probably best poised to do that maybe isn't Amy Klobuchar, a surprise.
Right.
Anybody else, I mean, she's the only one who's been sort of inching up and moving sort of in one direction.
Mm-hmm.
Which is credit to her. I mean, she's really done better than all but four or five of these folks.
That's right, yeah. She's held her own very well, and she has some money to do things at this point. And it's really going to come down to the next 30 days, because, you know, as we mentioned a little while ago here, we've got three or four candidates who all really need to win Iowa or do very, very well or exceed expectations. And she maybe is not quite as placed as well as the other four, but again, we've had lots of different people who have done very well at various stages in Iowa as the voters are giving them a look, and maybe she's going to peak, you know, in the next month.
We've had people, you know, circling up and then circling back down, and that's what she says is that she's peaking at the right time. Well, she may just be right.
We're right. Well, and the proof of the pudding will be 30 days.
Right. In 30 days. It is remarkable that it is all happening that fast on top of this sort of tableau of extraordinary world events. And you and I will be on top of it. So
Thank
you so much for joining me tonight. As always, you do a fabulous job.
Thank you very much. And good night to all.
Good night to all. David Schultz, and you can check out his blog. Schultz's take, always insightful, always great analysis.
Spring is a time of renewal, so why not refresh your home with a little help from Blinds.com? We make getting custom window treatments a minor project with major impact. Choose from premium blinds, shades, and shutters. We even have options for your patio, too. Blinds.com invented a better way to shop for custom window treatments. There's no pushy salespeople in your home or inflated showroom prices. Our design experts can help you find the perfect window treatments on your schedule. We'll even send free samples directly to you. Plus, we can handle the measuring and installation for you. Unlimited window treatments installed for just one low cost. And with Blinds.com, you'll always get transparent pricing. No hidden fees. Our free shipping and 100% satisfaction guarantee can put the spring back into your step. And into your home, too. Shop Blinds.com right now and save up to 45%. Up to 45% off for a limited time at Blinds.com. Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.